Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
I would like you to picture, for a moment, the traditional victim from the true crime stories that you've read and watched and listened to your whole life. What does that person look like? How does she act? Yes, I said she. How do the authorities involved handle that case? What sorts of grisly details are eventually revealed, and how are they presented to you? I will stop here, but you probably have a pretty good image in your head right now. And that is not to knock true crime stories. As you may know, they are very popular among podcast listeners. It is just to get you to think for a moment about how entire genres can sometimes be defined by stereotypes and cliches. Which brings us to today's story. Yes, a true crime story. But the victims in this story are men. They are vulnerable, and they've vanished. Several of them in recent years from roads across Vancouver Island. They've never been found. It keeps happening. Nobody has answers. And the reason that you've probably never heard about this story, unless you live in the community where it's happening, is, well, we just talked about the true crime stories that usually get told. This isn't one of them. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Laura Palmer is a veteran reporter and broadcaster. Right now, she is the host of Island Crime, which launches Season 2 on the Frequency Podcast Network on Monday. Hello, Laura.
Hey, Jordan.
Why don't we start before we get to the general topic of Island Crime and how you ended up in this business in the first place. Who are the Gone Boys?
So, in the series, I focus on half a dozen stories. There are more, but I'm focusing on these guys for a few reasons. They are men between the ages of 14 to 50 who have disappeared in recent years from Vancouver Island. And when I say disappeared, I mean they're just gone. They all have a few things in common. And one of the main things is that they have some measure of disability or trauma in their lives. And they all are known to be, well, not if not exactly loners, guys who spend a lot of time alone and spend a lot of that time walking or biking along the highway on Vancouver Island. And so while there are a number of other men currently missing on Vancouver Island, these are the men that I focused on in the series, men who have those things in common.
Why did you want to tell the stories of those men in particular?
So Island Crime is something I started last year. And in the first season of Island Crime, I was telling the story of a young Indigenous woman who had gone missing from the community of Nanaimo in 2002. And in my research on her story, I joined a number of different groups here on the island that are focused on crime and missing people and that sort of thing. And once I was part of these communities, I noticed a number of people asking the question, why isn't anyone talking about the missing men? Where are the missing men? And this was something I saw popping up in virtually every group I was part of. And so, of course, I was curious about those stories. And when I started digging around, I found that, sure enough, there were these cases out there that had received really very little attention. There was, you know, one or two stories that had been written about these cases. But, you know, with some of these men, there hadn't even been, you know, a single story done. And some of these guys aren't even featured on the RCMP's missing person website. So I felt like, you know, there hadn't been much attention paid. And I guess the other thing I would say on this point is, you know, I was a journalist in Vancouver in the late 1990s when women were going missing from Vancouver's downtown east side. And I remember a similar kind of thing happening where people from the downtown east side community, family and friends of these women, were, you know, trying to get people to pay attention. And what was happening was the, you know, the police, the authorities were saying, look, these women are, you know, leading lifestyles that are chaotic and there's nothing unusual about them, you know, being missing, being off the grid. And so police, the public, the media were all kind of not paying attention. And so similarly with these guys, I feel like there really hasn't been the focus on their stories because people look at them and say, well, you know, they have a mental illness. Some of them are, you know, at times homeless. Is it really that unusual for them to just wander off? Why should we care?
I want to dig a little deeper on that because you made a great point about the missing women in Vancouver. I'm speaking to you from Toronto, where we had a similar problem in that the LGBT community was trying to get police attention for years for men that were going missing in the village. And nothing happened until we eventually realized that there was a serial killer on the loose. Now, I'm not making any assumptions about what's going on in the story of your missing men, but why do we keep making that mistake?
Yeah, you know, I talked to Kim Rossmo, who was a detective involved in the missing women's case. He's now a criminologist at the University of Texas. And I asked him that question. And, you know, he said, every time this happens, reports are written, like this is going back decades. Every time there's a major case like this, people write reports. You know, it happened with Bernardo. It happened certainly with Picton. And the reports get written and there's a bunch of conclusions around, sometimes around communication, but definitely about how missing persons cases are handled. But in some respects, it comes down to a few things. You know, he said these kinds of investigations, serial killer investigations, are incredibly resource heavy. And you've got police, you know, dealing with budgets, of course. And so do they want to commit to the kind of resources it takes for this kind of investigation? And then there's the reality that serial killers are quite rare. And so that's true. And so if you're looking at a missing person, especially in cases where you don't have a body, you know, it's easier to think, well, there's other things that could have happened. And so why not assume that rather than look at all of these cases as a whole? One of the things he said to me was, in this case, it could just take more people going missing, like a larger number, before anyone decides to look at whether or not there's a pattern.
Well, you raised that possibility right out of the gate in episode one. How real is the possibility?
Well, I think it's very real. I feel like after talking to family members and talking to friends of these guys, some of the other things you might typically think of with the missing person just are really quite unlikely in these cases. You know, for someone, for example, with a serious brain injury, it's really unlikely that they're going to have the wherewithal to pick up and establish a new life somewhere else. And I think the same is true in a number of these cases. They just don't really have the capacity to do that. Other things like the possibility of suicide, the family members I've talked to, again, just say they just don't see that in these cases. Not that it isn't possible, but it's not as likely to them as the possibility that something happened to them. And for sure, there are possibilities, you know, that these men, some of them might have wandered off into the woods and had an accident. All of those things are possible. But I think when you start to look at the numbers of cases and the fact that there are no bodies and they've just simply disappeared, over time, I think you have to at least consider the possibility that these are not missing people, they are homicides, and that some of them could be connected.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Some of these men are indigenous. As you mentioned earlier, the subject of season one, Lisa, was a young indigenous woman. There is somewhat of a history of non-indigenous journalists attempting to tell these stories and not always getting it right, or not often getting it right. How did you navigate that as a white woman?
I'm very conscious of that, first of all. And I would say I had the good fortune during my time at the CBC, where I was previously employed, of working alongside a number of Indigenous reporters. And I learned a lot from them. One of the things we used to talk a lot about was how simply showing respect and taking the time when you're going into communities is just something that you can do to try and make sure you do get it right and that you don't make some of those mistakes. And so for three of the missing men are in the town of Duncan and part of the Cowichan tribe. And so when I was going in to talk to their family members, their friends, talking to their chief, you know, in advance, I tried to learn what I could about the community. And then when I was there, I just really did my best to listen carefully and to try, and when I told their stories, to make sure I was providing history and context that make those stories understandable, but also help the listener understand that this is a community that has been through a lot of trauma and that these stories are part of that history. I hope I've got it right. One of the things I also do, well, with all the families, but in particular with this community, is to check in and stay in touch. And so I in advance of the series coming out, I have been in touch with the families and with the chief as well, who the day I called him to tell him this was coming out, they had just, you know, lost someone to COVID, and their community is being really hard hit by COVID. So again, you know, it's like trauma upon trauma in these communities. And yes, it is really important, or I felt it was really important that I was aware of that.
How much do you think the fact that some of these victims are Indigenous and that Lisa is Indigenous plays into the lack of progress by law enforcement into these cases?
Well, let me start, I guess, by talking about Lisa's case.
Sure.
I asked the police that when I finally got to speak with them. The lead investigator, you know, said he really did not see racism, systemic racism, playing a role in their investigation. Now, he is quite new to the case. He wasn't involved in the early part of the investigation. But, you know, Lisa's family see it differently. You know, when they talk about how the officer who first came out kind of took a look at Lisa's mom, Joanne, who is Indigenous. And, you know, she told her family that she really felt like right at that moment, he kind of said, hey, she's probably out partying on a bender. Call me back in a few days. And she, you know, she felt like it was Lisa's Indigenous heritage and her Indigenous heritage that got that investigation off to a slow start. The families in Duncan tell me that, you know, that unless they keep agitating, unless they keep hassling, they don't get any answers. They don't get updates, that they really feel a level of frustration right now. I have not been able to understand really what's happening in those particular cases with respect to the investigations and whether or not the fact that these people are Indigenous have anything to do with why they haven't been solved. I don't know that.
How do you go about making the transition from journalist to independent podcast host, especially investigative mystery podcast host? I mean, we've talked before, and one of the things that you've told me is that, you know, the notion of a middle-aged white woman playing armchair detective is kind of a true crime podcast trope. And, you know, how did you end up here and how does that sit with you?
Okay. So first of all, I will say I do have a sense of humor. I get why people would kind of chuckle at the whole kind of Jessica Fletcher, Murder, She Wrote kind of thing. I get that. But I would say, you know, as someone who spent decades in journalism, I have really good research skills and I have good analytical skills. And I also have the luxury of time. This isn't, a daily news show that I'm doing. I can take the time to, you know, spend months trying to cultivate an interview. And as a result, you know, I get to talk to people who maybe have never spoken to the police. So, you know, I don't have a badge. I don't have the access and resources of law enforcement. But in season one, I would say I made progress in an investigation in a way that was like incredibly helpful to the case. I interviewed people who had never come forward before and, you know, raised the profile in a way that no Crime Stoppers video ever could. So that Lisa Marie Young's case is like very hot right now. And I think that is in large part due to the podcast.
I do want to ask you, while I have you here, about true crime in general as a podcast genre, because it is, I think everybody would agree, the hottest podcast genre. And you are Frequency's first true crime podcast. And you know, there's a reason for that, which is, frankly, that I think a lot of people find some of the true crime podcasts out there a little bit exploitive and not victim-centric. And I want to ask you about how you approach telling stories like this that are going to be painful, that are going to be nasty, and can come across as sleazy, I guess, for want of a better term, if they're not done right.
I get that for sure. I think for people who haven't listened to a true crime podcast, they might make all kinds of assumptions about what they're going to hear and what it's going to sound like. And there is such a huge range of storytelling within the genre that I get why people might think, oh, this is going to be creepy, it's going to be exploitive, uncomfortable, all of that. And Gone Boys is a true crime story. It is, you know, at its heart, there is a mystery in this story. But I would say it's more than that. It's a story about people. It's a story about loss. It's a story about class and poverty. And it's about place. You know, I have people who tell me they're so happy to see something being said about Vancouver Island and the people who live here. And I guess the other thing I would say is in journalism, there can be a bit of what I would characterize as like snobbery around people who tell crime stories. You know, that there's this sense that, well, if you're telling stories about politics or business or the environment, those are important, deep stories to tell. But I would say the same can be true of true crime, that you can tell crime stories in a thoughtful, intelligent way. And that's what I'm trying to achieve in Gone Boys and in island crime in general.
It's a fascinating approach to the genre. Why don't, before I let you go, tell us a little bit about who we'll meet in season two. You know, you kind of sketched out the scenario for us, but who are these boys, really? Who are we looking for?
So I'll start with Brandon Kearney, who is the first man, the first story that we delve into in episode one. Brandon is a young guy. He was 31 when he disappeared from Port Alberni. His story is really so heartbreaking. He's a teenager when he has a horrible car accident and suffers a terrible brain injury. And his life is changed forever. Up until then, he's, you know, a basketball player, a star athlete. He's just like, you know, this charming, handsome guy leading a great life. And then he has a car accident and his life is altered. He gets into a little bit of trouble with the law, but really he's just trying to keep his head above the water, I would say. And he's spending a lot of time walking. He's out on the road all the time. His girlfriend at the time said he had like terrible headaches from his brain injury, and just being out and walking was one of the only things he could do to kind of keep that horrible sound in his head at bay. One day, people at the drop-in center where he, you know, used to come in and check in and say hi, noticed that he's not around. And they call his family, they call his uncle, who also lives here in Port Alberni, and they realize nobody's seen Brandon for some time. And that was 3 years ago. And so his family just has no answers. And I'll just briefly tell you about some of the other guys. Desmond Peter. Desmond is the youngest of these men. He was 14 when he disappeared. And I met with his mother and his father and his grandmother and his auntie. And they are all just devastated by his loss. You know, his mother recalls like driving down the road. She's out looking for him. She sees him on the other side of the highway. And she shouts out to him. And by the time, you know, she's stuck in traffic on the highway, by the time they turn the car around, he's gone, never to be seen again. There's another young guy from that community, Ian Henry. He was just a young guy, 25, when he goes missing. Ian suffers from schizophrenia, and he can't cope without his medication. And yet, he's just gone. And his father, who now doesn't live in the community anymore, you know, searched the woods along with other community members, just trying to find Ian, any sign of him, but nothing. And that community, really, they have mobilized the whole community to be out searching. There's actually three men from that community missing. They've searched everywhere. No sign of these guys. Nothing.
It seems impossible to imagine that they could all vanish without a trace and have it not be connected. But I guess that's what we'll find out in season two. Thanks, Laura.
You're welcome, Jordan. Thanks.
Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. You can subscribe to Island Crime wherever you get your podcasts or at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. And if you stick around till I finish my little bit here, we will play a little bit of episode one for you. In return, I would like you to do something for me. We are launching our first ever Big Story Podcast Audience Survey. We want to know a few things from you. We want to know what topics you like on this show, what topics you don't. So if you'd like to help us out, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You'll get a prompt popping up in your browser. You can follow that link. I will be off this show for the next 2 weeks. I'll be back February 22nd. In the meantime, we have some amazing stories for you. You may know Fatima Syed from her role as guest on The Big Story. She will be taking over. Thanks for listening. I will see you February 22nd. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk then. And here, as promised, is a little taste of Island Crime Season 2, Gone Boys.
Brandon's mom is a striking woman. She has shoulder-length, shiny, silver hair. She's wearing a pretty scarf and matching cream sweater. She is also wearing a mask. It's the time of the pandemic. Linda gets into the back of my husband's SUV, where we maintain a distance across the vehicle.
Mom, my name is Linda Cole, and I am Brandon's mother.
She opens a bag full of mementos of Brandon, and the first thing she pulls out is a flip phone.
I brought my old phone. And the reason I brought my old phone is because the last message that he sent me was on September the 12th of 2017. And I had asked him if he'd gotten home because he lived about 10 minutes away from me. So he appeared day or night anytime, which he was able to do and I was happy with. Yes, I'm home now, Mom. Thanks again for the superb roast beef you had. Have a good night, Mom. Love you too. XOXO. So that was the last communication that I received via text from him.
Next, Linda hands me a picture taken the year Brandon graduated from high school. It's a very different image than the one I've seen on the missing posters. He is a handsome young guy. Big smile, thick dark hair, wearing a bright red basketball shirt.
He was on the basketball team, the high school basketball team. He played basketball through junior high and senior high. He was a soccer player. He had numerous trophies for track and field. He was extremely athletic, 6 foot tall, size 13 feet.
Linda reaches in and pulls out a canvas.
Oh. You know, he would make things out of nothing. He painted this the spring of the year he disappeared.
It's a pretty little painting of a table overflowing with fruit and vegetables, with the ocean as a backdrop and the sun beaming down on an umbrella. Linda tells me she loves the sea, and Brandon pictured her under the umbrella. There is something sweet and childlike about this picture. I ask Linda to reflect on what Brandon was like as a little guy.
He was almost 11 pounds when he was born. It's a large baby, just always on the go, loved to be with other people, very athletic, ran cross country.
I want Linda to give me a better sense of Brandon. She starts by describing his love of music.
Quite often he'd be playing the stereo on quite loud and he'd have to knock on his door and say, "Turn it down, buddy. There's other people in the house." We were sort of an average family. Three boys went to church on Sunday. You know, pizza and movie night on Friday night, that sort of thing. Yes, he had some really good friends, really nice young men. And there, I used to call it summer house because the back door would be open and the front door be open. There'd be kids flying through all the time. Yeah, that's when he was happiest.
Hi there, I'm Gavin Crawford. I'm a writer, an actor, and a comedian. And for the last 8 or 9 years, I have been navigating life with my mother's increasing dementia. Has it been sad? Yeah. Has it been funny? Also, yeah. That's what my brand new podcast series, Let's Not Be Kidding, is about. It's the true story of my life as a comedian, my mom, and dementia. Let's Not Be Kidding, with me, Gavin Crawford. A new 7-part series from CBC Podcasts, available now.